From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, we explore creativity. We'll look at uncreative writing.
Who cares about art grade? Nobody. Nobody cares about real poetry. What people care about is kind of the language that's around them.
We'll learn how to steal like an artist.
As an artist or a young artist, you're only going to be as good as the stuff you're surrounding yourself with. You're literally a mashup of what you let into your life.
And Suzzy Roach talks about how she channels the creativity she uses for writing songs to write her debut novel.
It's almost like going to a river and fishing or something. There's a river where this stuff comes from, and for me, it's very mysterious. I hardly ever feel that I've done something, created something by myself.
But first, Jonah Lehrer. He's a contributing editor at Wired Magazine and a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. Lehrer's also the author of three books. His latest is called Imagine: How Creativity Works. Lehrer tells Steve Paulson that our standard definition of creativity is completely wrong.
For thousands of years, I think we've seen creativity as this single mode of thought, and that some people have it. Those are those wacky creative types. And the rest of us are just doomed to repeat their inventions, that creativity is this all-or-nothing phenomena, and that most of us just don't have it. And that just isn't the case. What you actually discover when you look at creativity from the perspective of the brain is that creativity is actually a catch-all term for a series of distinct mental processes. Sometimes we have epiphanies in the shower, and sometimes we chug Red Bull and caffeine and just keep on working and working and working. So there are many different ways to get to the answer, and you know, the particular approach we should seek at that moment should depend on the type of creative problem we're trying to solve. And, you know, what you also discover is that creativity is embedded very deep in our programming code. Creativity is really this fundamental trait of human nature. We are all naturally creative. We are connection machines.
Now, are you saying that different things happen in the brain to spur us to be creative? I mean, it's not just a one-size-fits-all, and there are different parts of the brain that get tapped?
That's exactly right. So depending on the type of creativity you're engaging in at that moment, different parts of the brain are going to be involved. So the imagination doesn't have a single substrate. The imagination is really a series of distinct networks within your head.
Let's talk about some examples here. You write about Bob Dylan, about the time when he was really burned out. This was back in the 60s. You know, he'd already become a huge name. But he talked about actually giving up music at that point. He seemed to be sick of it all. And so what happened?
Yeah, so this is this interesting moment in Bob Dylan's career where he's transitioning from being primarily a folk singer, singing on political themes, writing classic songs, iconic songs like The Times They're Changin', Blown in the Wind. And he's sick of that. He's sick of being this rock poet who speaks to relevant political issues, but he doesn't know what to do next. He has no idea how to reinvent himself. And so he tells his manager that he's quitting the music business, that he's done with the singing, done with the songwriting. He's going to move to this remote cabin in upstate New York, and he's going to paint and write his novel. Didn't even bring his guitar. And so he's there for a couple days and you know, not writing any music. He feels free. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he gets this itch. He says it's like the ghost takes over his mind. And the ghost just begins writing and writing and writing. And he describes it as like this vomit of words coming out of him. Vomit is his verb. And he can't stop it. He needs to get it out. It's this uncontrollable insight. And over the next few hours, he writes more than 25 pages of ambiguous, vague, obscure lyrics. But within those 25 pages are the lyrics to Like a Rolling Stone. And it's that song, that six-minute rock single, that would really reinvent Bob Dylan's career, that would show himself, that showed Bob Dylan what he was actually capable of.
So you're saying that he actually found a different way of doing music, of writing a song.
Exactly. I mean, Like a Rolling Stone broke every rule in the rock and roll business. It was way too long. It was 6 minutes. It was not a transparent love song. It was not clear at all what Bob Dylan was singing about. It was full of obscure rhymes, lyrics that made no sense. It was this collage of influences. You know, for the first time, Bob Dylan could really bring together all its influences. So there was a bit of Fellini, a little Brecht, some Robert Johnson, some Woody Guthrie, all these different influences for the first time coalesced in this one song. And I think that's really what made Like a Rolling Stone so influential, not just for Bob Dylan, but for every other rock and roll artist since.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown. Like a rolling stone.
Now, what's striking about the story is that he got stuck. He got to a point where he felt like he couldn't go anymore, but somehow the getting stuck seemed to be essential to moving on to the next level.
Exactly. It came at his darkest moment. It came when he quit. It came when he hit the wall, when he had no idea what else to do. And then it came out of the blue. And when it arrived, it felt like a revelation. It came attached with this feeling of certainty. And those are both defining features of this very particular creative moment called a moment of insight. And the defining features of this moment, as defined by psychologists over the last few decades, are one, the answer comes out of the blue. The answer comes when we least expect it. The answer comes often after we've been stumped, after we've been blocked, after we've basically given up. And then once it arrives, it feels like the answer. We don't have to double check the math or reread the lyrics. We know this is what we've been waiting for. Now, it's a very, very mysterious mental phenomenon. It's as if the cortex is sharing one of its secrets. And yet, psychologists and neuroscientists have found some very interesting ways to study it and to really understand how the brain engineers these epiphanies.
So what's your guess as to what might have happened in Bob Dylan's brain? What parts of the brain might have been activated?
Yeah. It's tough, obviously, to speculate on Bob Dylan's brain in particular, because that's a special 3 pounds of Jell-O.
There might not be any other brain like that.
Yeah. But boy, it'd be fun to get him in an fMRI machine. But what scientists have found, and they've been forced to study moments of insight in some very clever ways, because obviously you can't just put undergrads in a brain scanner and say, okay, have a breakthrough. Do it now. That'd be a very inefficient way to collect data. So instead, what they do is they give students, they give undergrads, they give their subjects a series of creative puzzles, which are often solved in moments of insight. And that allows them to study the underlying brain substrate behind these moments of insight. And what they discover is that a few seconds before the insight appears, there's typically a sharp spike in activity in a part of the brain called the superior anterior temporal gyrus. It's a part of the brain nobody knows too much about. It's in the back of your right hemisphere, just behind the ear. It's previously associated with things like the processing of jokes and the interpretation of metaphors. And what it seems to be particularly good at is drawing together remote associations. So looking at two ideas that seem completely unrelated, seem like they have nothing in common. You know, what this one brain area seems to be good at is finding that thin thread they actually share. So it's able to draw together seemingly disparate and disconnected ideas and find the connection between them. You know, of course, when you need an insight, that's often a very, very important talent.
Well, there are some fascinating implications to this. I mean, if you work in an office, for instance, where you are supposed to be doing creative work, and, you know, chances are you're going to be focused, you know, very intently at the task at hand. But you're saying maybe you need to actually get away from that for a while.
Yeah, that's exactly backwards. I think we've got this very narrow notion of what productivity is, that productivity is being well caffeinated and being chained to your desk and staring at your computer screen. But when you're solving really hard problems and when you get stuck on that problem, that's the worst possible thing you can do. It's in moments like that that you should get up from your desk and take that walk, take that hot shower, play some ping pong, do whatever it is you need to do to get relaxed. There's this great line of Einstein's, which is that creativity is the residue of time wasted. You know, I think that captures a lot of wisdom, that sometimes we need to get better at wasting time.
You tell some great stories of breakthroughs in all kinds of walks of life. One has to do with an engineer at 3M named Arthur Fry. What did he manage to come up with?
He managed to invent this product. You may have heard of it. It's called the Post-it Note. And he came up with it in a very, very interesting way. So 3M, for several years before Arthur Fry invents the Post-it Note, there'd been this guy who had been working on a very weak glue. He'd been working on developing an adhesive that was so weak, it barely stuck things together. And engineers at 3M had this vague intuition that this might be useful, but no one could figure out what it could be used for. Because after all, if you want to use a glue, it's generally because you want things to actually stick together. So what's the advantage of a glue that doesn't actually work very well? So no one could figure out what to do with it. And so the product had languished on the shelves for several years at that point. Fast forward, Arthur Fry, he sings in his church choir. And he's got this annoying problem where he puts bookmarks in his choral book to mark the pages that feature the songs that he's going to sing that week. But as he turns the pages and holds the book, these bookmarks often fall out, and that's very frustrating to him. So one Sunday, he's listening to a sermon, and it's a particularly tedious sermon that week, and he starts to daydream. His mind wanders off. And it's at this point that he connects his problem, his bookmark problem, trying to fix the bookmarks in his choral book, to this very weak glue he'd heard about the week before at 3M. And all of a sudden he realizes that what he needs to do is coat his bookmarks in this very weak glue. And maybe, just maybe, the glue will be so weak that it'll stick the bookmarks to the pages, but won't tear the pages when he wants to move the bookmarks around. So it's, in a sense, a temporary fastener, a temporary stick for these bookmarks. And he then spends the next few months tinkering with the product, and eventually he realizes that if you really want to sell the product, it shouldn't be a bookmark, it should be a note that you can leave comments on and you can post to documents, because then people like, well, you know, actually consume it. And a few years later, the post-it note is introduced and is now, of course, a staple of offices everywhere. But what makes that story so interesting to me is that it arrived in the midst of a daydream. It arrived not when Fry was at his office plugging away, but when he was listening to a slightly tedious sermon and just let his mind wander off.
Yeah, and the implication is that boredom has its values. Sometimes you need to hit a spot where, for whatever reason, your mind is taken away from the task at hand.
Absolutely. And this also explains why studies by Jonathan Schooler at UCSB have found that people who daydream more also score higher on tests of creativity. You know, daydreaming is one of the first states of mind we drill out of our kids. You know, in second grade, you're told, stop staring at the window, focus, focus, focus. But daydreaming is actually a really important mental mode. We spend, some studies estimate, up to half our life in the midst of a daydream. The brain consumes tons of energy while daydreaming. It's because all these different brain areas are engaged in this elaborate crosstalk. And we're making new connections, we're mashing up ideas, we're exploring counterfactuals. It's a very rich kind of thought. And we should, you know, we should encourage it. We should learn how to daydream productively. And I sometimes wonder if one of the reasons there are so many anecdotes now about people having their best ideas in the shower is because the shower is one of the last places we can't take our phones. We can't take our smartphones. And so we can't check our email, and we can't check Twitter, and we can't check Facebook. And so we're forced to actually daydream for a few minutes, you know, while shampooing our hair without interrupting that process. And so maybe that's why the shower is this, you know, this incubator of good ideas now.
Hmm. Well, this also raises questions about how groups can come together to cook up some new idea. And every office knows about brainstorming, you know. Every business has brainstorming sessions, you know, how to do this. But you say that actually most brainstorming is not very effective.
Yes, brainstorming is a technique pioneered by Alex Osborne. He was a Don Draper-like figure, the head of BBDO in his day in the late 40s and early 50s. In a series of best-selling books, he introduces this idea called brainstorming. Very simple technique. The first rule of brainstorming is thou shalt not criticize. Whatever you do, don't criticize, because the imagination is very meek and very shy. And if it's worried about being criticized, it'll just clam up. So you can't criticize. That kills the imagination. Brainstorming has since gone on to become one of the most popular creativity techniques of all time. It's used in boardrooms and advertising offices and schools and design offices. Whenever you want to come together to create an idea, we often talk about brainstorming. The only problem with brainstorming, because it is a feel-good technique, you know, it's nice not being criticized. We can all feel very productive because we can fill a whiteboard with our free associations. No one said their feelings hurt. The only problem with brainstorming, though, is that it just doesn't work. Study after study has shown that brainstorming actually gets in the way, that people do better working on their own than they do coming together to solve problems using this technique called brainstorming. Now, the reason brainstorming doesn't work gets back to that very first rule, which is thou shalt not criticize. Studies led by Charlene Namath at UC Berkeley have consistently shown that when people engage in acts of debate and dissent, they actually solve solve problems better, they have more ideas, and these ideas are rated as better by an independent panel of judges. So there's something about criticism, about constructive criticism, that instead of shutting down the imagination, it really draws it out, forces us to engage, forces us to listen, really means there's some skin in the game. It wakes us up, and that's a good thing. And so she argues that the real problem with brainstorming is the fact that instead of kind of unleashing the imagination, it's just a little bit boring. It doesn't fully stimulate us. Instead, debate and dissent do.
But doesn't it depend on what kind of criticism you offer? Because so often criticism does shut down the conversation and people don't want to participate then.
Bushy argues, you know, the criticism should be constructive. It should never be personal. And you know, obviously, this is a very tough thing to manage. So I think that's the challenge, obviously, with encouraging people to engage in acts of debate and dissent. It's ensuring that it doesn't get too personal. But what she's found is actually that debate and dissent do the opposite, that they don't shut us down in general, that they really do wake us up. One of her most interesting findings comes when, after the experiment is over, a few hours later, she then brings people back into her lab and she says, okay, since the study was over, and you know, in a typical study, she might ask people to come up with ways to reduce traffic in the Bay Area, for instance, the San Francisco Bay Area. She'll say, okay, since the study is over, have you had any more new ideas since? You know, we haven't been asking you to think about it, but just, is the problem still in your head? Are you still mulling it over? Are you still ruminating on it? And what she finds is that people in the debate and dissent conditions have up to 7 times more new ideas than those in the brainstorming conditions, that they can't stop thinking about it, that there's something very motivating about being in an atmosphere that features debate and dissent.
John O'Lehrer is the author of Imagine, How Creativity Works. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think of John O'Lehrer's thoughts about creativity? Do you have any creativity tips you'd like to share? You can send them to us via email or Facebook. Our website is ttbook.org. You'll find a link to the Facebook page there. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, singer-songwriter Suzy Roach talks about her debut novel, and Austin Kleon tells us why it's okay to steal like an artist as we continue our Hour on Creativity. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Some creative people express themselves through music. Others pour their vivid imagination into novels. And there's still others who do both, like Suzy Roach. She's best known as one of the founding members of the folk rock trio The Roaches, along with her sisters, Maggie and Terry. But Suzy Roach has turned her attention from writing songs to writing fiction. She's just published her first novel, Wayward Saints. It's the story of Mary Saint, the troubled former lead singer of the rock band Sliced Ham. How much of an adjustment was it for Roach to go from stage to the page?
You know, it's much more solitary writing a book, obviously, and it's much longer to write a book. And there's a story and a visual element. It's almost like watching a movie, writing a book, watching it in your own little brain or dreaming it up or something like that. But then again, I was trained as an actress, and I also think that my songs are kind of character-driven most of the time anyway. So in that way, there were similarities.
So you've been creating characters to sing about all this time. One of the differences, I would think, is that writing songs, there's a more immediate feedback. There's more involvement, maybe because they're shorter. I don't know, because you can sing them to somebody. You can't exactly read a chapter of your novel to your sisters, can you?
No. It's a big commitment for someone to read a book. It's a lot shorter if they listen to a song. Someone has to be willing to go into an entire world, an alternate universe. I think it's harder these days for people to concentrate that much on an entire book.
On the other hand, you talk about being a character on stage. You were trained as an actress, you said. Are you, when you perform on stage, someone in addition to yourself?
Yes, I've always thought of it that way. I've always acted like a singer. I think that part of my job is to entertain people on stage, and so I'm not particularly that entertaining in my regular life. Actually, I'm kind of shy, so I always approached it as a character.
Was it appealing to you because of that to move that world into a world of fiction away from the world of performance?
Yes. Well, I wanted to write about faith, really, and that's what I think is at the heart of my novel. But I did want it to have a sort of fantastical world, and I think the world of rock and roll is totally absurd, and it sort of meshes very nicely with the world of faith because there is an unreality about both things.
Well, and we're always told to write about what we know, and certainly you know the world of performance. I'm not sure that the world you describe in Wayward Saints is one that I think of the Roaches as inhabiting.
Yes, the Roaches were a folk band, you know. I mean, we were not rock and roll like Mary Saint is. I wanted to write about a girl rocker chick, somebody like maybe Eminem, you know, who I think is brilliant, but, you know, a lot of people won't even listen to him because of the language he uses or what they think he might be talking about. And I think that's very similar to the issues of faith and God. Some people are just totally turned off by the whole subject. So again, those two things were parallel, and I needed to create a character who was so extremely objectionable to some people. And that's what I tried to do with Mary.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about those worlds running parallel to each other, because it is hard to imagine faith in the rock and roll world of Mary Saint. Part of what you've done in the novel is to bring faith into her life, but also to have a sort of parallel story of her mother going on at the same time.
Yes, I think that the perception that her mother has of her, she's almost afraid of her daughter and the behavior that she has, you know, adopted. And Jean Saint, the mother, is a very religious Catholic, and almost everything about Mary, her daughter, goes against that. So it's very painful. Plus, mother and daughter and the father, who was an abusive father in their family, you know, they've all suffered a big pain. I wanted the two characters to approach healing from their separate corners, really.
Maybe the best way to get an idea of the main character, Mary, is to have you read a little bit of the story. Do you have a section that you could read, and could you introduce us to it?
Yes. This section is sort of midway through the book when we first really meet Mary, and this is after her band has, the star has risen and crashed, and she is left in her own life with no friends, no business relationships anymore, and she's sort of just stunned at what has happened to her, and she's sitting at her kitchen table remembering her life on the road. The memories of what her life once was were absurd. Adventures on that thing called the road. Sometimes it seemed as if a person could fly, but the humiliations and failures were so extreme, so public. Rave reviews and then vicious dismissals. All those stained toilet bowls and sticky floors, freezing dressing rooms, dented aluminum ashtrays overflowing with cigarettes and joints, platters of curled-up salami and wilted American cheese, bottles of tequila with worms at the bottom that were supposed to be swallowed, posters of bands, mostly guys in leather pants, their crotches bulging, hairy arms inked with tattoos of girls and dragons, photographs of herself posing with electric guitars in ridiculous outfits that she had thought she ought to wear, ripped stockings, garter belts, and makeup like war paint, attitudes, her own and everyone else's, songs that she wrote from the heart and what they actually turned out to be, who people thought she was and who she really was, who she thought she was and who she turned out to be. Fans cheering, "We love you, Mary Saint, sliced ham, sliced ham." It had been a long tilt-a-whirl ride, the predictable cliches, hotel lobbies, airport bars, and the exquisite uniqueness of those very same cliches. The world was a carnival, the ghoulishness, the costumes, the buffoons, the down-and-out, drug-laden, liquor-soaked, good old times, the goofiness, the innocence, the mistakes and cruelties, the magical shows, the mixture of fakery and truth, the sadness and the laughs, all the things that people used to say about her, to her, the things that she had said, shooting her mouth off, hurting herself and others, being cheered on like a pit bull in a ring. All of this led up to the death of Anthony, the event that had cut her life in half and ended his. This is what she remembered of herself. She'd wrestled with her lover until he fell to his death off the balcony of a hotel room. Why? Because in the end, someone in a newspaper said that she was fat and stupid. She had lost herself along the way. This was all she had to go on.
That's an extraordinary description. In some ways, it's almost as though she's looking back at a novel of somebody else's life, isn't it?
Yeah, and I do think that that does happen to people when they get successful. When you're successful, it happens very quickly. You just get on the train and you don't stop until one day it's always going to end, you know? I mean, there's never going to be just a constant trajectory of success. There's ebbs and flows. And with her, it was over. The day it was over, it was over. And I think that happens to a lot of people in this business.
The act of writing this was more inward, more personal, but it's about a world which is more outward. And I suppose that the world performance does rely on other people more.
Yes, it's mysterious what makes somebody popular. There are some people who are so talented, they could do everything, and for some reason, they don't have an audience. And then there's someone like Mary Saint who has this kind of inexplicable talent.
In your mind, I know we've talked a little bit about the difference between songwriting and novel writing, but I'm really fascinated by whether the well of creativity is the same in both. Somewhere those characters live and you have to find them to write about them, don't you?
Yes, and I think, again, that's where the issue of faith comes in. It's similar to writing a song. If you sit there and put the time in, something will come out, and it may not be what you thought would happen. It's almost like going to a river and fishing or something. There's a river where this stuff comes from, and for me, it's very mysterious. I hardly ever feel that I've done something, created something by myself.
I'm curious, I guess, also about the creativity involved in songwriting, because you have to be pithy. It doesn't give you much time to flesh out characters, does it? Whereas a novel demands that you fully realize characters.
Yeah. In that way, they're really opposite. And in fact, after I wrote Wayward Saints, I wrote the song for Wayward Saints. I was curious to see what would the book be if it was a song. And I guess the difference is that you take the essence out of the thing. It's almost like squeezing an orange and getting the juice out of it. When I finally wrote the song, I said, oh, that's what the book is about. And I thought that was an interesting reversal to go from the book to the song.
What's the matter, baby? You look sad and lonely, like you're about to fall apart. Why not look me in the eye? Tell me the reason why. You don't trust anyone. Your crooked path and fall from grace. A shadow cast all over the place. You're cracked up, but you're holy too. Hurt because you're black and blue. Yeah.
That's Suzzy Roach, along with her daughter Lucy Wainwright Roach, performing Song for Wayward Saints. Suzzy Roach is the author of Wayward Saints. If you have questions or comments about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, the fine art of stealing, like an artist, and uncreative writing as we conclude our hour on creativity. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Read any good books lately? Well, if not, maybe you should write the book you want to read. That's just one of the pieces of creative advice that writer and artist Austin Kleon offers in his book, Steal Like an Artist, 10 Things Nobody Told You About Being Creative. Kleon talks with Anne Strainchamps.
The title is a playoff of something that's actually misattributed to Picasso. Good artist copy, great artist steal. As far as I can tell, Picasso actually never said that. It was actually T.S. Eliot. He was talking about poets. I was shocked myself to find out how many artists really use that term, stealing. And it's not just artists, it's people of all fields. Someone like Steve Jobs or Kobe Bryant. He talks about stealing basketball moves when he was watching tapes when he was young. Someone like Francis Ford Coppola will say, you steal when you're younger, and then you add something new to the pot, and then pretty soon people are stealing from you.
It's so interesting, though, because you're talking about people who we think of as some of the great creative geniuses, and we have that idea that what's really valuable in art or business or entertainment or, you know, whatever your form of art is, what's really valuable is originality.
Yeah, and in human history, the whole concept of originality is kind of an invention of the 19th century. We really don't have this idea of a lone creative genius until the Romanticists really come along. Before, someone had a genius or they had geniuses that kind of like guided their lives. But then when Romanticism comes around, we have this idea that there's like this person that's kind of ordained by the gods with this unique creative ability. I guess my big quest with the book is to just kind of upend that a little bit and to say, actually, nothing comes from nowhere, and that all these creative geniuses that we think of, they were all thieves, and they all borrowed liberally, and they took things and they reworked them, and their genius, if you can call it that, is actually the way that they take their influences and gave us something new.
So you take this concept of stealing like an artist. If art is theft, then there should be a skill to it. And you sort of turn it into almost a lifestyle. So can you kind of start going through some? I mean, if you're a young artist starting out and somebody says to you, no, 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 don't worry about being original, just go out and steal. What do you do?
Well, it's almost like a conceptual thing. It's almost like a way of thinking about what you do. My big thing that I tell young artists is that you are a mashup of what you let into your life. And that actually comes from something my mother used to say to me, which used to drive me insane. She used to say, garbage in and garbage out. That drove me so crazy when I was young, but now I realize that she was dead on. There's a DJ named DJ Spooky, and he says, as a DJ, you're only going to be as good as your record collection. So what that means is, as an artist or a young artist, you're only going to be as good as the stuff you're surrounding yourself with. And that includes not only the books you read, the art you look at, your teachers, but it also includes your environment, where you choose to live, your friends. It's everything. You're literally a mashup of what you let into your life.
Okay, well, so as a young person, let's say you say, great, then I'm going to make sure that all the music I listen to is really great music and that I only read the best literature. Then what? I'm going to wake up one morning and make great art?
I think what happens is after you start gathering your influences, then you start copying. And we're not talking about plagiarism here. We're talking about learning the moves. Like, if you're Kobe Bryant, you watch the tapes, you know, you see Jordan's moves, and then you try them out on the basketball court. Now, what happens is, as you try to copy these heroes, you start realizing that you're not quite built like them. I'm using the basketball metaphor because I think it's easier. You start realizing that your body's different, that you have to start adapting, that you're incapable of perfectly copying these heroes, that you have to make adjustments to suit your own personality. The stuff that you have through your life influences and things like that starts seeping in. And then after you start copying your heroes, you start combining them together to get interesting combinations. And then finally, I always think of it as like you take something from one hero and you take something from the other, and pretty soon you have this kind of Frankenstein monster of your work. And then part of your job is to start transforming that monster into something smooth, something that kind of stands on its own.
At what point did you begin doing the newspaper blackout poems?
The newspaper blackout started right after I got out of college. You know, I studied creative writing in college. I actually did go to, like, creative writing workshops. And the thing about creative writing workshops and about college in general is college is this perfect environment for a young writer because you have a captive audience. You've got people paying to read your writing, your fellow students, and then you've got a professor who's getting paid to read your writing and pay attention to it. So you have like what every artist or writer dreams of, this captive audience. And then when you get out, you realize that no one cares, you know, that you like have to start from ground zero and you have to build a readership and you have to do something that people aren't artificially paying attention to you. And so when I got out of college, I had no outlet anymore. And I froze up. And I submitted a few short stories to journals and got rejections just like every young writer. And I suddenly realized that I was writing short stories. I mean, I like short stories, but that wasn't really what I wanted to do. I wrote short stories because that's what they teach you to write in college. So I started a blog. And one of the things about having a blog is you have to fill it with something. And one day I was staring at my Microsoft Word screen and that cursor was just blinking at me like it was taunting me, you know, and I was trying to like pull something original out of my soul, and I looked in the recycle bin with all these newspapers stacked up in it, and I thought, man, I don't have any words, but right there next to me are millions of them. So I picked up one of my drawing markers and I just started circling words and then blacking out the rest, and I thought I was ripping off the government. I thought I was doing like redacted CIA haikus. But it turns out that there was actually this long history of people finding poetry in the newspaper. After I started posting them to my blog, people started telling me that there was this long history. But instead of getting discouraged that my idea wasn't completely original, I built my own family tree. I researched the form. I went back as far as I could go. And I stole everything I could from the people who came before, and I tried to make my poems better. And in a couple of years, I put out my first book, Newspaper Blackout.
Do you remember one? Can you recite any?
Yeah, probably one of my favorites, or a kind of a fan favorite, is called Overheard on the Titanic. And it was actually a music review. And it's very short, but it goes, I mean, yes, we're sinking, but the music is exceptional.
Austin, when you give these talks to young people now, what do you say at the end?
The thing I say at the end is YMMV, your mileage may vary. I say there are no rules. Have fun. Make up your own rules. Take what you can from me, steal what you can, and make your own thing.
Austin Kleon is the author of Steal Like an Artist, 10 Things Nobody Told You About Being Creative. He spoke with Ann Strainchamps. Could you imagine taking a class in uncreative writing? A class in which you're penalized for showing any originality and creativity. Instead, you're rewarded for plagiarism, plundering, and stealing. Well, if this sounds appealing to you, then Kenneth Goldsmith is your man. He teaches an uncreative writing course at the University of Pennsylvania. Goldsmith is also a poet, writer, and author of the book Uncreative Writing, Managing Language in the Digital Age. He tells Steve Paulson that literature is in a rut, and has a ways to go to catch up with other art forms.
Much of the most popular music is made entirely from cutting and pasting. Nobody would dare play drums on a track today. You sample drums. This is happening in art. 100 years ago, Marcel Duchamp took a urinal and recontextualized it, didn't do a thing to it, just put it into a different context. And that's already 100 years old, and that's old hat. Somehow, writing has never engaged with these ideas that are rampant all over the rest of culture.
So you're saying the digital media has challenged writers to do something different, maybe to be more experimental, and in the process to give up some of our old ideas about what creative writing is all about, what originality is all about.
Well, I actually don't think that this is really that unoriginal. As a matter of fact, you can cut and paste in very original and very unique and very expressive ways. You can create an entire novel that you haven't written that nobody else could write by the way that you've cut, pasted, and sewn it together. I mean, this, again, of course, goes right back to hip-hop tracks and things that nobody even would think twice about in other parts of culture.
Well, I have to ask you about an event that you were part of, actually, at the White House. So President and Mrs. Obama's Celebration of American Poetry. And I know you read some of your work there, including a piece called Traffic. Can you tell me about this work, Traffic?
Well, I mean, it's a transcription on New York radio. We have wonderful traffic here in New York. New York News Radio, a wonderful station that's very old called 1010 Winds, is round-the-clock news. Every 10 minutes, they give the traffic report. So this was a book that was 24 hours worth of traffic reports every 10 minutes on the ones, as they say.
Could you give us a sample of this?
Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. 431. Remember how bad it was yesterday? It's starting again. The east side delays begin at the Tarry Borough. It's pretty much one long line now all the way to the Battery. The west side delays to the Battery begin back at the Boat Basin at 79th Street. We've got a ton of interior traffic in Midtown. 7th Avenue, Times Square, that's the delay. That's where it all gets going. It comes out of Central Park. Broadway and 8th Avenue is going to be impacted by that as well. On the east side, side streets are packed through the 40s and 50s, and that's why 1st, 2nd, 3rd, Park Avenue right now, an absolute mess. So trying to get around Manhattan just like yesterday is not going to be easy at all. Across the East River, already a ton of traffic each way on the Brooklyn Bridge. Now the Manhattan Bridge is bumper to bumper coming into Manhattan, jam-packed on the upper roadway to Brooklyn. The lower roadway is also a mess. 59th Street Bridge is getting real bad. The belt is jammed east off the Verrazano. Some types of problems on the way west toward Coney Island. And right now, heavy transit delays. Be sure to budget extra travel time taking the LIRR out of Penn Station. There you have it.
So that's what you read to President Obama.
I read traffic reports to the President of the United States.
And how did that go over at the White House?
They loved it. They absolutely loved it. It was very funny because I chose to put together a little set about an American icon, the Brooklyn Bridge. And so I read three short pieces, an excerpt from Walt Whitman's Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, written in 1840 before there was a bridge there. And then I went through Hart Crane's poem about the Brooklyn Bridge, which is a kind of a disjunctive modernist thing. And then finally ended up with Traffic, what I just read for you. Now, the audience, who was really senators and mayors and, you know, Democratic Party donors, sat there very politely and quietly through the Whitman and the Crane, the real poetry. But when they heard the traffic reports...
They were laughing, I bet.
They were howling. There's a shot of Obama leaning back in his chair with a giant smile across his face, listening to the traffic report. Maybe it's vernacular. I mean, maybe this is just language that people can understand, right? I mean, who understands Hart Crane? Who cares about Hart Crane? Nobody. Nobody cares about real poetry. What people care about is kind of the language that's around them. And of course, these are Washington bureaucrats, so they had ideas about gridlock and congestion and delay. You know, there really is narrative in there as well, in a way that Whitman gives you impression or Crane gives you disjunction. I'm actually giving you narrative, but I didn't write any of these. So this is the weird thing. The most avant-garde, the most unoriginal, the most uncreative work was the work that went over the very best in the White House.
Now, you are not only a writer, you're also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and you teach a class called Uncreative Writing. Can you tell me about this class?
Sure. In this class, students are penalized for any shred of originality or creativity that they show. They must be uncreative for an entire semester.
Meaning what they write can only be taken from other sources, copied?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They can only appropriate, transcribe, copy, you know, the kind of stuff that I do.
And why is this the requirement of the class?
Well, the idea is to move away from what you know. As a college professor, I can get them better at writing. But quite frankly, at the University of Pennsylvania, they all know how to write pretty well, particularly, you know, at upper levels. So what are we going to do? We're going to keep honing that short story so you can, you know, market it. That's fine. It's somebody else's job. My job is really to challenge them and to get them to think differently about what writing is and what the creative process is. We do exercises, and one of the best exercises we do is I just tell them simply, with no further instruction, I say, retype 5 pages. And they shrug their shoulders and they leave the class. But the next week they come in with the assignment, 5 pages, and that's where it gets very interesting. What did you choose to type? How did you choose to type it? Why did you choose to type it? And suddenly, all of these autobiographical ideas and ideas of choices and tastes all come into the seemingly innocuous idea of retyping 5 pages. And suddenly, they go, aha, I wasn't thinking about that, but of course I was making choices, and making choices is an uncreative slash creative act.
But you're also, it sounds like, asking your students to plagiarize what someone else has already written, right?
Absolutely.
Which is the kind of thing that usually gets students kicked out of school.
Well, you know, I encourage plagiarism. You must plagiarize in my class. You know, these kids are so good at plagiarism, but they always have to do it surreptitiously. And, you know, in my class, I say, you may not do it surreptitiously. You've got to put it all out on the table. Now tell me why you did it. Let's get responsible about your plagiarism. What choices did you make? When kids plagiarize, they're not really thinking about the sort of formal choices that they're making. So it becomes an enlightening thing. Now, of course, academically, this is really the worst thing you can do. As a matter of fact, at the end of each class, I make them buy a term paper from a paper mill and put their name to it and turn it in as their final project. But then they've got to get up and they've got to defend it as if it's theirs.
But you're supporting a corrupt industry of, you know, the people who write those term papers for someone else and for someone else's name.
Absolutely. We are. And the best time is when we can get university funds to actually purchase these papers.
I can't imagine how this goes over with other professors, with other writers. Some people must be furious at you.
No, nobody's furious. You know, listen, no animals were harmed during the making of this movie. This is safe. This is consensual. It's like an S&M club. You know, you go in and you role play and everybody's cool with it. You know, and those are the rules. This is the thing about a classroom. I mean, it's controlled and it's safe. And really, nobody's really getting hurt here.
So what do you think students learn by taking your uncreative writing class?
Well, I mean, they learn to make decisions and they learn to become accountable. I mean, everything must be articulated. It's more like what I would assume law school is like. You have to learn to take somebody else's point of view, even if you don't believe it. I mean, this is happening sort of in the legal profession all the time. So you're getting outside of yourself. You're adopting things that aren't yours. You're judging language in a very different way than you've ever seen it. And the best thing that can come out of this, I think, is one of the great things is that they reject this way of working. I say, look, suspend your disbelief for a semester. And then, if you don't like this way of working, you can actually say, again, it's defensible, I've tried it and I don't like it. This is crap. But often what happens is this becomes another tool in a writer's toolbox. And I think this is actually a very contemporary tool for writers to be using.
It sounds like you're saying that even though you call your class uncreative writing, this is an exercise in creativity.
Creativity is sort of so formulaic and so sort of bankrupt at this point that it's really, I think, the thing to flee from.
Why is it bankrupt, though?
Creativity is not creative. You know, it's the 100,000th coming-of-age novel. Actually, I want to talk about the shortlist for the 2011 Man Booker Prize.
Okay.
4 of the 6 shortlisted novels advertise themselves as featuring immigrants negotiating the difficulties of a strange land. 5 of the 6 hinge on the dramatic turn of a murder. 4 of the 6 reveal secrets from the past that come unexpectedly to light. I mean, this is from the website of the Man Booker, okay? 5 of those through the surprise arrival of a letter. 4 of the 6 reveal the unreliability of narration and so on, they're all kind of formulaic. And this is what's passing, really, for the what we're calling the best literature. That's not creative to me.
You're saying there's nothing new to be said anymore. It's all just rehashing what someone else has already written.
Well, you know, I think there are new things to be said. Who hasn't been moved by a beautiful memoir or by a beautiful novel? I don't want to be so prescriptive in that way. But again, I feel that we've limited ourselves to these sort of same variations on narratives, and it's kind of time to open up the field a little bit more to other ways of being, those ways perhaps being uncreative or unoriginal.
But I think the response that you get from a lot of novelists is it's not just the themes that matter, it's the way you put together the sentences. It's the use of language to create imaginative spaces. Are you saying that's not important, or we've just misrepresented that?
No, I'm saying that is important, but I'd actually say that the way that those texts are constructed are fairly conventional and fairly similar. Again, there's a whole century of experimentation with language, which is completely ignored. There's many, many ways to construct novels. We actually just tend to construct novels quite similarly. Just a call to open things up. Let's get a little more contemporary.
Kenneth Goldsmith is the author of Uncreative Writing, Managing Language in the Digital Age. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Imagination. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.